Radio. This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Yes, everybody, you know the drill. We've started this podcast to help anyone who is remotely interested in trapping and neutering animals. We're the help we did not receive when we first wanted to get involved, and we want to be your new besties in the TNR world. I'm Alex, one of your hosts for this ride, and I'm so grateful to have Adele by my side.
Hey Alex, how you doing? We also have Sam with us here today. How are you doing, Sam?
Not bad, how are you?
All good. Excited to be talking to you all the way from the Philippines. Can you tell us whereabouts you're based?
Yes, so I'm currently based in the southern part of the Metro Manila area. There are a lot of stray carers here who tend to be young women without any prior experience, without any support, etc. So I think what Alex, you said, you know, how many people enter into this world without any resources whatsoever. And I think especially in the global south, where cities are facing such a massive population crisis of stray animals, this is such an important resource to be able to access.
Awesome. Cool. Well, to introduce Sam a little bit. So Sam is a vegan stray cat carer and animal welfare organizer living in South Metro Manila area of the Philippines. Her expertise lies in stray-centric cat care, biosecure spay and neuter events, neonate kitten care, providing training and support to local stray carers, and how all of that plays into her career in decolonial urbanism. So today we're going to be talking to Sam about a whole bunch of awesome stuff like that, but also your experience in organizing mass spay and neuter events. And ultimately, why you decided not to continue due to ethical concerns around biosecurity and care of your patients, which is a pretty cool, pretty strong like stance to take when we're trying to engage in care and there's so much need for care. But to make sure we do it the right way, we're really interested to get your thoughts on that today.
Yeah, thank you for openly starting with that. And I also wondered if many people in other parts of the world that you guys are interacting with, do they have similar challenges, concerns? How does this usually play out? Not only in the ethics of it, of course, but in terms of the logistics.
So I think one of the reasons why this is such an interesting topic is because we all know people who are in stray care in all different parts of the world. And a lot of people tend to have the approach of kind of from a place of emergency need, of urgent need. There's all of this crisis happening and we just have to do something no matter the quality of that. So I think quality of approach is varying in all different kinds of places and is very closely linked to the resources and the capacities that we all have. But we do all care about the well-being and the welfare of the animals we're setting out to care for. So we all draw a line somewhere in terms of quality of care, and it's just about where. Everybody has a different marker for that, I guess. So you're in the Philippines. How long have you been there, and how did you originally find yourself there?
I've been here since 2020, and I didn't intend to live here. I just kind of arrived here. I thought I was going to spend a few weeks here. And then COVID kicked in with the lockdowns. And the Philippines was one of the countries that just kept its borders closed for a really long time. And so I was here for 3 years. I decided to stay here for lockdown because I had, you know, like there were 2 days when it was like you could get out of the country if you wanted to, but otherwise the borders are closed. And if you leave, you will not be able to come back essentially until the lockdowns were formally lifted. And there were many families, for example, who were trapped at the borders and they couldn't basically return to the country. Because, for example, like there was a foreign spouse or the children are of a different citizenship, etc. So there were many, many cases and the government didn't budge. And so this lockdown was in place for 3 years. And so that, I think in 2021 was when I first met Mom, the first stray who brought her kittens over, and they became the first family that I took in. And I started learning from there about stray care. As you said, no one was able to help. Everybody is in their own emergency mode, right? In the local area and across Metro Manila, across the Philippines, etc. And I learned, I would say, the most online. I read a lot of veterinary literature, so scientific journals, etc. I read a lot of those things. And I'm very grateful to have found very aligned vets. I think this is one of the biggest limitations in Global South, of actually cooperative vets who also care about animals and are not interested in harming them. I did not realize just how widespread it is about, you know, the sheer concerns within the veterinary field, especially here in the Philippines, where, you know, there is a great need. So that's how I started getting involved. I realized that stray carers don't seem to have a handle on things. Many of them I saw, you know, doing their best and trying what they had, but ending up just sort of perpetuating cycles of abuse, and doing so in a way that served them more so than the animals in their care. And I began to see this as an extension of urban trauma. So I started talking about urban trauma in stray circles and et cetera. And this is closely linked to the work that I do around decolonial urbanism. And everything just became so clear. Everything was so linked with domestic abuse, with, you know, the lack of facilities for disabled people. You know, everything just became very, very intertwined, especially in the urban space, which is extremely disenfranchised. So I kind of found myself in this wide open space, trying to understand what my contribution is in there. And at the same time, being able to access information in a way that, you know, the vast majority of people can't. You know, vast majority of people don't read veterinary journals for fun, I guess. But I was doing research based on the cases that I was facing and based on, you know, a certain understanding of the limitations of veterinary knowledge within this country and especially experience. I think a lot of Global South spaces also lack veterinary training that is kind of more up to date, or I would say more normal across the Global North. And they don't get the opportunity quite often in their own work to actually advance their own skills. So these are some of the reasons why I wanted to try and see if it was possible to start organizing mass spay and neuter events. We call it kapon here in the Philippines. It just means to sterilize. And so our kapon events are designed specifically to fit within the budgets of stray carers here. And usually stray care here has a lot of volunteers, so you're not short of volunteers, but you're certainly short of sort of awareness, knowledge, and a vet team who can collaborate with you on the biosecurity issues that you're scared about, that you're worried about, that you're concerned about. There are very real risks, especially at the types of scales that we're looking at when, you know, some of these kapon events they're targeting numbers like, you know, 1,000 cats in one afternoon. And they'll stack them shoulder to shoulder and for the photo op, you know what I mean? And there'll be, who knows what kinds of things are being passed around with the types of conditions that strays in the Philippines have. So that was one of the things that I set out to try to do to see if it was possible for myself. And I was surprised that I was able to achieve that. And I'll be happy to share some of the steps that we take in organizing the events and how we arrange situations on the day itself as well. But I would say, like, the biggest limitation is a vet team who are happy to work with you. So for us, like, we absolutely start there. And well, as you said, Adele, we also ended there.
Yeah, I think we've talked to a few people who have who are organizing these mass spay and neuter events with either a clinic that they work, that they operate full time, so like kind of a normal clinic that adds on like spay and neuter days or spay and neuter interventions. So they have a team of vets who are there full time, who they've participated in training with and setting specific standards. And this is a completely different experience to what you had and what a lot of us have, where we are either outsourcing a vet team or we're taking animals to private vet clinics, which are, you know, their priority is not spay and neuter. It's definitely not doing mass spay and neuter at a particular quality. And then when we're bringing in vets from other teams, from other clinics to help with these events that we're organizing, like you did, they have their own experience and education and standards that they bring. So yeah, do you want to talk a little bit more about that? Perhaps how you went about it, what some of the main difficulties were?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to share our experience with it. So as I said, the first and most important thing is a vet team who are just like able to meet your basic needs. And for us, that's number one is biosecurity. Number two is respect. I think it's almost shocking to look for respect nowadays. People sort of like get treated so badly in the stray care space, and they take all sorts of, you know, abuse essentially. So for us, it's really important, not necessarily just to feel good, but to ensure that there is a dependable team that you can rely on amongst the vet team, whom, you know, you don't know really what their motivations are until you have a good enough experience of working with them. So for us, that's a vet team that is communicative, respectful, certainly punctual is a very important one for us, capable and professional and able to take and give feedback. So we're really interested in a very collaborative relationship with a vet team who can meet, you know, all our needs. So that would absolutely be the first. And I would say also, like in Global South contexts, it's not unreasonable to expect that every 6 months there might actually be a new vet team on the market who could fulfill those needs. And that is actually what happened to us. So even though we stopped, we were able to start again. And the second thing that I would think is the most important is your volunteer team. So these are the stray carers that preferably are in your local area. But to be honest, like in our volunteer team, we even have people come from outside the city to be able to volunteer for that experience and to learn how we set up events, etc. And so our volunteer team are the ones who obviously engage the public. They are the ones who set up posters around communities, etc. They're the ones who answer questions through phone calls or through emails, who promote veterinary services in the city or in the area, and also provide advice on responsible care. They're the ones on the day who manage the biosecurity protocol, the crowd control protocol. They're the ones who support the vet team with the logistical issues, etc. And I would really say, based on my experience organizing with different volunteer teams, what you really need is a core of 3 or 4 people who are just like, you know, absolutely dedicated to improving their practice and willing to train others as well. And once you have that, it's really, you know, the whole thing runs on its own, and no matter what situation, it's easy to face that together. And then beyond that, there's, you know, the standard things like the local government unit. You need to have support from them. Otherwise, you're really in an uphill battle. The homeowners association, same thing. And then the other logistical things, the big items are venue rental, furniture rental, etc. And so these are the things that I would say are the basic things that you need in terms of organizing. Without this, you cannot have an event. And it takes months to build those relationships as well and to have something that you feel is that you can be confident of having a successful event, because why would you set yourself up for failure when you can set yourself up for success?
Well said.
Yeah. So a lot of these things, as I said, take time. And again, this is coming back down to the volunteer team and their dedication, their knowledge of the area, the relationships that they've already been building. Quite often, there's a political side to it where many people just don't, for example, people in the local government unit just don't see the need to prioritize. And so we move on. We just go to another neighborhood or another, you know, we don't stop there. We don't let that get us down. Same with the homeowners association, etc. We don't push where it's not, you know, it's just not worth our time. Basically, we're looking for people to collaborate with, not to argue with people who won't.
Samantha, can I ask you a few questions about what you just said?
Yes, please.
First of all, did you learn the local language before you tried to build any relationships?
No. And this is the other thing. My intervention as an urban specialist is not to be the one who leads it directly, not to be the one in charge, but to support the ones in charge. So when I was originally starting out with the experiments, the first experiments that I did, I could only do that because I had already created solid relationships with stray carers who were willing to take that lead role.
Okay. And those stray carers you're mentioning, are they mostly locals?
Yes, they're all locals. And they're a range of, so the one I work with most is Athena. And she actually started caring for her colony where she grew up, which is in an informal settlement with zero resources. And I managed to meet her online. And I was obviously blown away with what she was able to do with, like, basically nothing. And it was from there that we built a relationship that I think, you know, led to her also realizing that this was something that she really wanted to do with her life. And so it was this kind of relationship building that took, I think it was about maybe a year and a half before we were able to do our first event together. And it was lucky because she really wanted to, it was a good time for her in terms of the relationships that she was making with her local primary school, who wanted to take care of their cats, but didn't have any resources to be able to do that. So in our first event, our first mass spay and neuter event, we had her cats, her colony, and also the school's colony. And so that set us up for proving, essentially, that the case that it was possible. Obviously, it was possible because I funded the whole thing. So money-wise, like, there was a ways to go, but it was, and I needed, obviously, the experiment was to be set up so that it can be financially sustainable for people who don't have the resource. But in the first place, I think building the relationship and taking those risks, I think it needed that.
I really like what you've said. And as three international people working in animal welfare in countries where we're not from, this is pretty common experience for a lot of us. Like, we arrive and we meet other people who also care about these social issues. And it's pretty amazing what they've been able to achieve with such resource deprivation. And so what you've described is building a bridge between the people who want to do something and the resources to do it, bringing in information, maybe standardizing some procedures and helping administratively, maybe with fundraising as well, trying to up-level and optimize this so that link can be brought to the local community who wants it. Not fighting people. There are plenty of people who don't want this to happen. That sounds like a lot of wasted energy and potentially trauma in some cases, trying to make all of this work with people who don't want it to happen. And so identifying those allies and also trying to enhance their ability to do the work that they want to do is a really cool point.
Now, I want to also, like, I met a lot of stray carers who had a lot of financial resources. And I met a lot of stray carers who have nothing. And my initial goal was to try to see if I could create collaboration between classes, essentially between socioeconomic classes. We were successful for some time, but what I found was that as soon as I became less active in the group, those relationships tended to fall apart. So they tended to default to their sort of cultural, where I'm supposed to be narrative, and mistrust set back in. So I think there is a facilitative role, what you identified there, around kind of, like, I would call it just imagining a better neighborhood, imagining better relationships, you know. And sometimes it just takes a foreigner to come in, you know, and just sort of, there's no attachment, right? I come in with no attachment whatsoever. And I'm just, like, able to connect because of my privilege and, you know, the way that I speak or the things that I'm interested in. I'm able to connect in across different classes. And that was an experiment that I tried. And when I saw that it worked, I was hopeful. But then, you know, the reality of the culture is obviously more powerful than than one mass event or like one foreigner coming in to do things. And so that's part of it as well.
So speaking of the events more specifically, do you want to share a bit more about maybe some procedures or protocols or training that you did for both the vet teams and the volunteers and the local allies you had made, like some kind of agreed upon procedures that were important for this to happen?
Yeah, sure. Happy to share. So once you've found a vet team that you feel that you can trust, and this could be a series of conversations that you have before you feel that you can really like trust and engage them, then I would really recommend having some kind of written agreement about how exactly are we going to organize. So who's going to be in charge of advertising, who's going to be in charge or responsible for registrations, for booking the events, for setting up the furniture, for getting agreements from the local government unit and all these things. I would really recommend to have that in writing in an agreement itself, that you would be able to clarify all of the responsibilities with the vet team. So this would be responsibilities that the vet team would have before the day, on the day, and after the day, as well as for the volunteer team. So this should be a commitment between the vet team and the volunteer team. And wherever possible, we actually get all the volunteers to sign this agreement as well, at least the core volunteers, so that everyone has an equal share in the responsibility. You're all on the same piece of paper, right? This also is the place where you would clarify how payment and billing is done. Quite often in the Global South, this tends to be a flexible thing. It's not really talked about until after the day itself. But I find that, you know, it just takes the stress out of all of it because of the accounting that can be very messy on that day. And so usually there's someone who's specifically working on the registrations and the accounting. And usually because that involves not talking to the public, so usually that's me because I don't speak the local language. But yeah, so there are these roles that are laid out in this agreement, and I think also responsibilities. So that's definitely something I would say is very important and sets the expectations up front. For example, if you really cannot have a vet team who's going to show up 2 hours late to your event, then that should be in the agreement that everybody is happy to sign and agree to. So there are clauses that you can add in there based on whatever your specific needs are, etc. And then there is the thing about engaging the public online and offline. So I think a lot of advocates and activists are already very familiar with what works best in their local community, or rather interested in trying other things if what you're currently doing doesn't work. So who are you targeting, and what are you putting out there? What's your messaging? What's your communication style? All of these things are, you know, you can be playful about it. There are ways to reach out that could be more imaginative. What we have found is that offline outreach is actually more productive than online outreach. And I think partly, I'm not sure if this is specific to the Philippines, but partly, you know, there's so much toxicity online. Just meeting someone in person and just having a few minutes to talk about it and then get a little QR code to find more information out, that can be a lot more effective just to build that connection with someone. So this is what we found, actually, that has been one of the big learnings, I would say, that we take away from our different trials and experiments. And then, of course, there is the constant communication with the local authorities. I think it's always better to, again, this is something that we learned, it's always better to over-communicate and to do that in person in order to continue building that relationship, because ideally what you want is not just a one-time event, right? You want to do regular events, hopefully with the same authorities who can support in different ways, maybe in increasing ways, maybe to give you a discount on venue bookings or stuff like that. We've had a lot of different responses from a lot of different groups. And so it could be varying, but I think it's always worth to build those relationships, especially just in animal welfare advocacy to begin with. And then on the day itself, there's a whole bunch of procedures. We're going to be creating a website as well where all of this is kind of more laid out and explained about how we do our process. But essentially it starts with venue prep. So on that day, usually we arrive like an hour or 2 hours before the start of like when people come to bring their pets or the cats that they care for, cats or dogs that they care for. So there'll be venue prep, which includes setting up the furniture, cleaning, sanitation procedures, the disinfections, etc. That's all happening at that time. And then we start the registrations and the first checks. And this is where we start implementing the social distancing protocols. So essentially we need every animal to be in separate travel crates or cages. And those are placed 1 meter apart from each other. So we need like a really big space if we're doing, let's say 50 animals at a time, because it could be, for example, if you're doing a bigger event, and we spoke about this with the last vet team that we worked with, who had more experience doing sort of hundreds in a day. And so they would have like a basketball court full of basically crates that they would stack up usually. And so we said, you know, this is not okay for us because it violates our biosecurity procedures. We need social distancing to be taking place. And so we arranged with them, if we did happen to have, you know, that many, that we would break it into different arrival times for different groups so that we could use the same space and just keep sanitizing that space while the groups are moved on to the surgery recovery areas, pickup areas, etc. So there are different ways to do that in terms of still meeting the social distancing protocols, even if you don't have a huge amount of space to deal with. So usually at that time when people are bringing cats and dogs in cages, then registering, that's usually the time that the vet team starts setting up. So they'll arrive and they'll set up however they like to set up their surgery area, etc. And then the first surgeries would begin. So by that point, they would have a list of all the ones who are already registered and checked, and any specific, we would tend to also arrange animals according to whether they had specific concerns. So for example, if we notice any mild symptoms or anything that needs special attention from the vets in order to essentially approve them for surgery. Of course, the vets will do their own check anyway before surgery, but this is just a double layer for us to be able to highlight specific things to the vet team and take care also if we see any symptoms that we just need to be more safe about. We wouldn't put them in the same place that we assemble everyone else. We would put them in a more secure, biosecure area where they have limited exposure. And so then this is when the first surgeries begin. And then a lot of that time for me goes into administration. So I would be like checking that every cage is properly labeled and that the payments are done correctly. And I would start to essentially prepare the pickup information. So there's a whole bunch of leaflets, information leaflets and contact details and etc. Along with like numbers you can call, local clinics you can visit if there's something that goes wrong after the surgery, etc. So I would start preparing all these things for the pickup at that point. I would also start preparing the final documentation that we need to hand over to the vet team to confirm, you know, the numbers and the names and the contact details of all of the households who have brought pets and that are going for surgery, etc. And then there's also the waivers that need, so for the surgery waivers that need to be prepared and filled in completely for the vet team to take away. So there's all this admin stuff that's happening in that time while the surgeries are happening. And meanwhile, the volunteer team is speaking to so they're doing advocacy work. They're speaking to people who are waiting. They're promoting responsible vet care. They're promoting adoptions, especially. They're usually updating the local government unit to say that the event is underway and things like that. And then, of course, there would be someone would go and buy drinks and snacks or things like that. And then usually by that time, we have the walk-in consultations as well. So this is where the vet team would then provide. Usually there would be at least one vet who's already completed with their surgery assignments. And so they would be the ones who would take walk-in consultations, for example, vaccines or deworming, like more simple things that could be done without a clinic visit. And then usually by that time, it's sort of like wrapping up. We'll be doing our post-surgery checks for all of the animals who are completing the surgery and just waking up from anesthesia. And usually at this point, the vet techs would be going around doing the grooming or doing ear tips. And so this is the moment that we start engaging the pet carers or stray carers with recovery care instructions, medications, so all of the paperwork that they need to pick up, and if they want to buy medications or if we can recommend them a shop that's near to them, etc. We would talk to them about that. And then that's basically it. Pickups are done. And then we would debrief the volunteer and vet teams. This is where we seek feedback from everybody. The vet team usually then packs up and leaves, and then we do our closing cleaning and sanitation procedures. We debrief on our team as our own, and then one of the volunteers would go back to report to the local government unit again to say that we're essentially done, and then we would leave the venue. That would be it for us, and then we would do a billing after the event through email, usually with the vet team. So when we arrive, we usually come with like a van of like things. You know, we had this whole plan last time to set up an adoption booth and all these things, like a virtual adoption booth with pictures and posters and things like that. And it just didn't work out because there were too many things to prepare. And so that was one of the things that we just like couldn't get it set up for the day. Yeah, things go wrong all the time. Obviously, we tend to always have at least one or two disruptions. You know, for example, teenagers playing basketball on the other side of the basketball court when we booked the whole court. But obviously incredibly dangerous when you're doing surgery on site.
Yeah.
Obviously not so obvious.
It's really crazy. And we've had people just walk in and start like, I don't know, touching cages one by one. Like heading, like trying to get cats out of cages when they're like completely stressed. And it's like, okay. So you really need a team who's like really on watch and not, you know, at least aware of like the potential issues that could happen. Of all of the events that we've done, we've had only one escape, and that was when the stray carer was they didn't have a secure cage. This was the problem. So they were taking the cage out of the car that they arrived in, and then the cage sort of landed weirdly on the ground and then sort of broke apart. And then the cat just like ran off, and he was super feral and super aggressive. So it was really not a good thing. But that was the only case that we had in terms of like escape. We certainly had stray cats also, especially the males, the big males who wake up first and then try to walk off on their own, like right after surgery. And those are definitely the ones that we're like, okay, we already start to identify them before they even go for surgery, so that we keep a closer watch on them, etc. So like there are all these things that you learn, you know, what can go wrong, and then start to watch out for them and become more kind of like aware of where things could go wrong and like preempting them. But this is where it really helps, obviously, to have a really responsive vet team on hand. You can't handle all of these situations on your own if you're not already a very experienced stray carer. And especially when it's post-surgery, you don't want to cause additional injury to an animal that could then implicate the vet team. So there are some, I don't know, for me, I care a lot about like these legal responsibilities. Doesn't seem like many people in the Philippines do. It's more flexible here, I think. But I think it's always good to have that conversation with the vet team before the event itself, because you know something's going to go wrong, and always be prepared for all those eventualities, essentially. So this is generally, I would say, like our procedure.
It's an absolute ton of stuff to organize. And it's funny because we see all of these different like dazzling events. We neutered this many animals over a week, over a few days, whatever it is. And actually, the amount of organization that goes into it and things you have to prepare for is absolutely wild. Like, that's something I've seen a lot, is when you are organizing an event and inviting people to bring their animals in on their own, is they bring them in pretty random containers. And I've seen some posts and reels being like the funniest different kinds of containers we've had animals turn up in. That's actually a huge risk. And so you have to expect, as you've said, things like that are going to happen. And not necessarily because people are neglectful, but because you're in a deprived community trying to organize something that they have not been able to access. You can't expect everybody's going to have the most high quality container to bring their animal in. It might be a laundry basket. So that is something that we're going to have someone on our team making sure they do. Animals arrive. Do we have somebody checking that those kinds of containers are safe? Something we've talked about a lot amongst ourselves is different kinds of events like this that are organized in different places. So whether it's Bali, Indonesia, or in Mumbai, or in Mexico, like these events look different in every place. And it's easy to see some open air event organized on a basketball court with all these animals, like just being operated on all these tables, which is, looks very different to a vet clinic environment, which is just kind of the only option that we have to organize these events. But look at it and be like, that looks absolutely wild. That can't be safe. But ultimately, this is the reality of what a lot of these events have to be. And we're organizing with the resources that we can. But there do have to be some protocols and regulations around how we're doing that. So like you indicated, not stacking all the animals up on top of each other when we have no idea where they came from, and things like parvo and distemper and potentially rabies, ringworm, all these different types of parasites are crawling all over them from different parts all over the city. Yeah, that's probably not a very good idea. And so we kind of have to have some standards around that. So yeah, like these events may look different, but as you said, an immense amount of thought has gone into how to do it properly.
And I think one of the scary things is that the people who are perpetuating that myth that it's okay to do things that way are the biggest so-called animal welfare organizations in the country, right? There was one particular campaign that I had such a massive issue with because they wanted to do 1,000 male cats in one day. And when when you think of the numbers, so each of those male cats has a colony where they are mating with females. And they are the ones, male cats are the ones doing patrols, right? And they meet many, many female and male cats on their patrols every single day. So they are the ones who are going to have those diseases, pass on all of those parasites. And then you want to bring 1,000 of them together. What does that mean? You might as well times that by 20, and that's all the potential diseases and parasites that could be happening at that event. So we're talking about 20,000 potential cats exposed to parvo just from one day.
Yeah, it's not something to take lightly.
This is not, and this is done by, like I said, one of the so-called most experienced vet teams in the country, who are the biggest animal welfare advocates in quotation marks, who claim to be doing the most for animals, right? So these concerns, when you raise them, of course, they're met with like, you know, oh, but they're the experts. What can you say at that point, especially you're the foreigner, right?
Definitely.
Okay, we're running out of time, unfortunately, but Samantha has so much to talk about that I think we're going to have her next week again. But thank you so much, everybody, for listening to our episode. And Samantha, one last take for everybody who's listened to this episode. What is the most important advice you can give to anyone who might want to organize a big spay and neuter event? What would you tell them?
Very easy. If you can't do it safely, please don't do it.
And that is, yeah, that is it. Samantha, where can people find you?
Oh, I have no idea. They'll find me online somewhere.
Do you have any social media page, any email address, anything they can reach out to if they have any more questions?
Yes, so the folk can definitely reach us at Saudis Strays. That's us online. That's our volunteer team. And also for myself, you'll find my work on urbanism on urbandonut.asia.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much, Samantha, for joining us. And thank you so much, everybody, for listening to us. If you have any question, send us a DM on either Saving Lives with 2 A's or Travel Animal Rescue on Instagram. See you all at our next episode. And in the meantime, stay out of trouble and keep trapping to save the streets one animal at a time.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.